Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we're going to continue our study of the Sutta Nipata. And today we come to sutta number 12. This sutta is called the Muni Sutta. The word Muni means the sage. I said several times that there are two important themes that run through the Sutta Nipata. Two important types of suttas. One type of sutta is concerned with teaching, we might call, fundamentals of Buddhist ethics, particularly ethics of relevance to householders. We find these types of suttas, for example, in the Mahamangala Sutta, in some of the ideas in the Metta Sutta, some ideas in some of the suttas that we will come to later. And we could say that the ideas in these suttas constitute the backbone of the humanistic trend in Buddhism. We could say that they are almost the foundation for what Master Yunshin calls human realm Buddhism. The other important theme that runs through the Sutta Nipata, that appears in certain suttas, is a kind of celebration and acclamation or proclamation of the ancient Indian ascetic ideal. The ideal of the monk as the solitary wanderer who goes out seeking the ultimate goal of liberation, and then especially the celebration of the one who has achieved that ultimate goal, the liberated one, the arahant. The Buddha himself became a liberated one. As a Buddha, he was also an arahant, a fully worthy one, and he is called a Muni. The word Muni means a sage. And so we also know him as Sakyamuni. The word Sakyamuni, it's not a proper name, but it means the sage of the Sakyan clan. The Sakyans were the Buddha's clan. And the word Muni was used in ancient India to designate a sage who is characterized by the observance of a vow of silence. So even today in India, the word mauna is used to mean a vow of silence. And those who observe a vow of silence come to be called, as a kind of spiritual practice, come to be called munis. And so muni then takes on the connotation of one who is wise by reason of this vow of silence. There's a connection seen between silence and wisdom, and talkativeness and foolishness. And this doesn't mean that in the Buddhist understanding that a muni is one who is always silent. The Buddha, of course, spoke a great deal. But in the Buddhist understanding of a muni is one whose mind is inwardly silent. And though this person speaks, he speaks from this inner silence. And so the words of one who speaks from inner silence resonate with depth, with meaning, with profundity, with insight, with penetrative wisdom. And that's quite different from the speech of those who are addicted to talking. And who have to babble constantly. Their words are usually superficial and shallow. There's a saying, I think it comes from someplace in the Sutta Nipata, that the little creeks, little brooks, as they flow by, they make a lot of noise. We hear them burp, googling, 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 googling. But the great ocean is silent. You just faintly hear the sounds of the waves rolling in and out. Okay, so this sutta is called the Muni Sutta. It's a sutta, as the subtitle given by the translator, it's a sutta spoken in praise of the solitary life of self-control. And then taking up this theme, we could say that the Buddha is now hearkening back to this ancient Indian ideal of seeking the ultimate goal, pursuing this ultimate goal of liberation, of nirvanic peace with single-minded dedication. Within the Buddhist monastic order, the Buddha himself, after achieving enlightenment, he established a sangha, a monastic community. And within that community, different lifestyles are possible. And so the great majority of ordained monks live in settled monastic communities, members of, even in the Buddha's time, members of monasteries, or else they would travel together in groups, they would participate in communal affairs, they would have regular interactions with the lay community. But there were always at least a few monks who were very deeply dedicated to that life of solitary striving, who were inspired by the quest for liberation and wanted to pursue it just single-mindedly. So after receiving their basic monastic training, they would set out alone, not even living together with the rest of the Sangha, but always traveling alone, moving from place to place constantly, not remaining in any fixed residence. Other monks have their monasteries, their temples, their communities, but these monks are the true homeless ones who have no fixed dwelling place, no fixed abode. In our own time, such monks are rare. But I remember one from Sri Lanka who I respected very, very highly. He was a German monk who had come to Sri Lanka. He had actually been in Sri Lanka before ordaining, doing business during World War II. Then he was arrested by the British government because they were suspecting all German citizens, and sent to a prison internment camp in India, where he met some of the German Buddhist monks there, and there he became acquainted with Buddhism. And he was inspired by the Buddha's teachings. And so after the war, he came to Sri Lanka and became ordained as a monk in, I think, 1955. He was ordained at a place called Island Hermitage, and for 11 years, he just remained fixed at this hermitage, studying the Dharma. He was not a scholarly type, but he learned the suttas very well, learned them in Pali, practicing very diligently. Then in 1966, he felt that he had developed to the point where he could leave the Island Hermitage. And then he left, and he set out on a course of wandering. And from then on, from 1966 until 1987, that's for 21 years, he would constantly wander without remaining fixed in any residence except for the 3 months of the rains retreat. Occasionally, when he would come to a monastery, a hermitage that he would like, he might stay a few weeks, a few months even, in order to build up again the strength of his meditation. Then he would set out wandering again. So he traveled throughout the whole island of Sri Lanka many times without having any fixed plans of where he would be going each time. There's a little story that I heard. One time he had to come into Colombo, that's the major city in Sri Lanka, for medical treatment. And he had been there for several weeks. And so when people hear that he has come to Colombo, many, many lay people come to see him. They like to come to talk to him, to get his advice, because they respect him very highly. But then after having been in the city for several weeks, he decided to go traveling again. Now, from this monastery where he was staying, called Vajirarama, to the road that runs along through Colombo along the coast, that road is called Gaul Road. It's about 100 meters from the monastery to Gaul Road. And Gaul Road runs north and south. And if you go south on Gaul Road, it will take you to the south of the island. If you go north on Gaul Road, it means that you're going up to the north of the island. So this monk, the German monk, his name was Venerable Jnanavimala, he was walking down Vajira Road towards Gaul Road, and there was a Sri Lankan layman coming up and saw him walking down with his bowl and his carrying bag over his shoulder, and said to him, "Venerable sir, I see that you're leaving the monastery. Where are you going?" And Venerable Jnanavimala said, "I haven't decided yet. I'll decide when I get to the corner." Okay, so now we will turn to the sutta. Okay, first I will recite in Pali, then give translation and explanation. Santa vato bhayam jatam niketa jayate rajo aniketang asantavang etang ve muni dasanang. Okay, the verse means fear arises because of intimacy. It might be translated fear, or perhaps danger arises because of intimacy. Okay, now more literally, not sensual desire, but dust is born of, okay, we say household life. More literally, dust is born of a dwelling place. Without a home, without a dwelling place, and without intimacy, this is the vision of the silent sage. That is what's translated here. Homelessness and detachment is therefore appreciated by the sage. That's a rather free translation. I translated very literally. Again, without an abode or without a residence and without intimacy, this indeed is the vision or perspective of the silent sage. Okay, what underlies this verse was a particular incident that took place in the time of the Buddha. This is according to the explanation given in the commentary. It was a rather shocking incident. There was a monk and a nun who would become friendly with each other. Then their friendship became closer and closer. They were constantly seeing each other, constantly talking together, then sharing things with each other. Then that feeling of intimacy grew so close that even without their giving up their status as monk and nun, they found a secluded place and then had intimate relations. And then they continued to have these relations while still maintaining the form, the appearance of monastics, going on alms round, participating in affairs of the Sangha, but still maintaining these relationships until they were discovered and word went out and the news was presented to the Buddha, and then the Buddha called them up before him and reprimanded them for their conduct and told them that they would have to leave the monastic order. And then he explained to the monastics, the monks and nuns, the danger of having excessively close contact with one another. And he explains that this danger is that there's a gradual process by which you can say that feelings of romantic love arise. And the first step is through constant seeing of one another. That is, through frequent seeing of one another, that there comes the desire for closer contact. Then through closer contact, through speaking, constantly speaking to one another, that this feeling of a kind of confidence or trust in one another arises. Then when there's that feeling of trust arising in one another, then that is when sensual desire has the opportunity to enter into the mind. It's not that sensuality immediately arises, but it sort of comes in secretly in the background behind the It comes in the background, behind the cover, uses as its covering the feeling of close association, the feeling of friendship, the feeling of mutual trust. And once that feeling of a kind of sensual bond arises between the two, then it becomes very difficult to break. And so therefore, the Buddha advises males and females who want to live this life of homelessness, this life of renunciation, to keep a distance from one another, not to be in too close association. And he says that when there is a need to associate, then certain steps or measures can be adopted to prevent the feeling of sensuality from descending. He advises this for monks, whether they're dealing with nuns or with laywomen, certain steps can be taken. One of these, he says, is to develop towards all women certain perceptions. If the woman is older, old enough to be in the position of a mother, one develops the perception of her as being a mother. If she's in the age group to be a sister, one develops towards her the perception of being a sister. If she's in the age group young enough to be a daughter, one develops the perception of her as a daughter. Another measure is to develop restraint of the senses, not to allow the senses to go wandering over the objects, noticing, ah, she has nice hair, pretty eyes, beautiful smile, but to control the senses. And then as a general precaution against sensuality, the Buddha suggests to all monastics from time to time to do this meditation on the nature of the body that I explained in the talk that I gave last week, contemplating the different parts of the body, how the body is made up of parts like hairs of the head, skin, nails, teeth, skin, bones, flesh, different organs, different fluids. And when one contemplates the body in this way, then this urge of sensuality doesn't find anything to grasp hold of. Okay, so in this first verse, the Buddha gives the most basic advice for those who are dedicated to following that very strict path of renunciation and liberation. That is, to leave behind what is here called the home, or the dwelling place. And according to the commentary, what's meant by the dwelling place are the objects of attachment. So it doesn't have to be taken too literally that one has to give up one's actual home and go wandering without any dwelling place. But it means not to let the senses settle and fix upon their objects. And by not becoming intimate, doesn't mean that one doesn't have any friends, but it means that one develops a certain distance, a certain ability or capacity for detachment, so that one is able to organize one's scale of values, give a certain priority to one's values, so that when one recognizes the scale of values, one doesn't let one's mind be turned upside down and carried away by lower values to the point that they undermine and destroy one's higher values. Okay, then in verse 2, the Buddha discusses some of the radical measures that are to be taken by one who is striving on this path of liberation. Okay, I will recite this verse in Pali and then give translation and explanation. Yo ja tang u chi cha na ro pa ye ya ja yang tamasa na nu pa ve che tam ma hue kang muni nang charan tang a da ki so santi pa dang ma he si. Okay, the text says, one who cuts off defilements that have arisen, who would not plant them again, and who would not enter into what is being grown, he is said to be the solitary, wandering sage, that great sage has seen the state of peace. Okay, this verse uses the language, a particular metaphorical language, to speak about the process of training the mind. The metaphors that it uses are those of clearing the ground in a garden. Clearing the ground of weeds. And here the weeds are the defilements. And now when one is clearing the ground in a garden, what one has to do is pull up any weeds that have already been growing. And one has to prevent any weeds that might have taken root from growing up again. And one doesn't want to sow the seeds of weeds so that the weeds can continue to grow. That is the parallel or an analogy for this process of training the mind. Training the mind here is the practice of right effort. Right effort is one of the factors in the Noble Eightfold Path. So what one has to do is to train the mind so that whenever any defilements have arisen, one is observant enough to cut them off as soon as one sees them appearing in the mind. That is the training, the first stage in training in right effort. And one has to continually train the mind to be able to watch, to look into the mind at subtler and subtler levels, deeper and deeper levels, so that as one is watching, one is seeing even the seed formations of thoughts. And it is from these seeds of thoughts that thoughts arise. And when one sees the seeds of the unwholesome thoughts, the seeds of the defiled thoughts appear in the mind, one crushes out those unwholesome seeds even before they sprout and germinate in the form of unwholesome thoughts. And then one constantly trains oneself throughout the day through observing the mind, whether one is walking, sitting, standing, working, resting, not to allow the mind to become lax and to lapse into these unwholesome thoughts. That is called not entering into what is being grown. And this advice is given especially for one who wants to become a solitary wandering sage. For such a one, even in the process while wandering and walking over long distances, from village to village, town to town, has to be constantly training the mind with each step, not just walking and letting the mind wander, just idly looking at the countryside, seeing nice trees, nice flowers, smiling at the people, nice children, but always walking with the right step, training the mind, with the left step, training the mind, observing the mind, developing the mind. That is all part of the same process of cultivating right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Okay, then this analogy of vegetation continues into the next verse. Sankhaya vattu nipamaya bijang sinehamasananu paveche save muni jat Tikayan tadasi takkang pahayana upeti sankhang. Okay, this verse is now describing the one who has completed all of the work that is described in the second verse. The second verse is describing a disciple who is still in the stage of training, one who has gained some glimpse of the state of peace, but who has not yet completed the work, who is still working to subdue and to cut off the defilements. But this verse is describing the liberated one, the arahant, and it uses that same imagery of vegetation. The first line says, one who has more than considered, but one who is it's very, very rich and beautiful language. One who has comprehended all of the grounds. These are the grounds where one might grow vegetation. And these are the various objects in which the defilements might grow. And what is meant here are all of the objects of experience in which greed, hatred, and delusion might ordinarily find a foothold. That is, the things like the five aggregates, the 12 sense bases, the 18 elements. For an ordinary deluded person, that is where greed, attachment, hatred, anger, ignorance send down roots and grow up and entangle us in bondage. But the liberated one, the sage, has fully comprehended all of these with wisdom, and therefore greed, hatred, and delusion can no longer get a footing within these. So therefore it said, Pamaya Bijam. He's discarded the seed and no longer supplies moisture for the growth of that seed. What is meant here by the seed, and what is the moisture for the growth of that seed? The seed is consciousness. The moisture is craving. Now, what ordinarily happens, what happens for an ordinary person, is that because of our ignorance, we don't understand the ground or the basis. And so we constantly moisten the ground. That is, we send craving out into the ground, and then we scatter seeds into the ground. That is, through our karmic actions, we are constantly generating new life, new vitality into consciousness, so that consciousness has new potentials for sprouting within the round of existence, within samsara, arising in this form, that form, taking rebirth here, taking rebirth there, producing this form of existence. Now it becomes a human being. Then consciousness might take the form of a heavenly being, a deva. Another time, consciousness will manifest as an asura, that is, a titanic being. Then some other time as a hell being. Then as an animal, then again as a human being. It goes from one realm to another realm to another realm. All because we haven't considered or comprehended the ground. And so we are always supplying moisture for that ground, supplying moisture into the ground, and then throwing new seeds into that ground. And there's no patent on these seeds, but they are always bringing up new vegetation, new forms of life, subject to old age, sickness, and death. But here I don't agree with the translation. He says, having abandoned sophistry, that sage who has seen the end of birth cannot be categorically described. Not having abandoned sophistry, the way I see it, having abandoned, the way I would understand it, that's, I would take the third line of the Pali and say, that sage who has seen the end of births has abandoned thought, in that he has gone beyond the range of human thought, that no human thought can pin him down and comprehend him anymore. And so he cannot be categorically described. He no longer comes within the range of human reckoning, of conceptual understanding. This might be referring to a dialogue between the Buddha and a wanderer named Vachagota, when Vachagota is asking the Buddha whether the liberated one, the Tathagata, whether he exists after death, and the Buddha says, to say that he exists after death, that does not apply. Does he not exist after death? The Buddha says, that does not apply. Then does he exist and not exist after death? The Buddha says, that does not apply. Then the wanderer says, then is it the case that he neither exists nor does not exist after death? And the Buddha says, this alternative too does not apply. Then the Buddha says that any form, any feeling, any perception, any mental formations, any consciousness by which one describing the liberated one might try to describe him, that form, that feeling, that perception, those mental formations, that consciousness, those have all been cut off at the root, abandoned, utterly discarded, so that the liberated one no longer comes within our range of comprehension. Okay, then coming to the fourth verse. Anyaya sabbani nivesanani anikamayang anyataram pite sang sarve muni vita gedo agido nayu hati paragato hiho. He who has known all kinds of, I would say not births, but literally the text says all kinds of dwellings, places of residence. Here it's referring to all the different realms of existence in which living beings might dwell, including the highest heavenly realms, the most blissful celestial realms, but does not desire to enter into any one of them, for he sees that they are all impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise, that life in any one of them is unstable, unreliable. One dwells there maybe hundreds of years, thousands of years, thousands of aeons, but life there comes to an end and is followed by a rebirth someplace else. And again, the cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death starts over again. So such a sage, the Muni, the silent one, is freed from all greed, craving, and desire. He toils not. He doesn't make any more effort. He's free from any kind of striving, perfectly at peace, for he has gone beyond and reached the far shore. Like one who is still in training has to make an effort to struggle, to strive. That one is depicted as in the stream of the Dhamma, struggling to go from the near shore of samsara to the far shore of nibbana. But the one who has reached the other shore doesn't struggle anymore, but is now in perfect peace, for he has gone beyond. Okay, I will end the exposition at this point and continue with the exposition of the sutta. I will continue on December 17th. Okay, I thank you all for your attention, and I wish the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, share the merit. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mantaram. Tavata chamehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva numodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta numodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sattā numodantu sabba sampatti siddhyā.